Thank you very much. So first of all, as they say, Gama Nimit Starfa now. First of all, congratulations to Joe on this milestone. And how appropriate for the Coopers, who are such dedicators, to dedicate tonight. Dedicated people who dedicate. That didn't sound as profound as I meant it, but I meant it profoundly. All right. I also want to acknowledge that I see that this Beis Medrash is the Ornstein Beit Medrash. I know the Ornstein family also. I'm intimately acquainted with the story of Salik Ornstein, in whose memory this place was, this Beis Medrash, this beautiful Beis Medrash, is dedicated. One day, those of you in my Holocaust class, I will tell his story, which is an incredible saga. And now, as if it's not too late, we are at the end of Chag Simchatenu. I want to speak to you about the serious problem of happiness. I ask someone who's happy, invariably they'll point to someone far away, in the distance. America is smile city when it comes to a camera. You look at the advertisements, they can be a little more international. If you're from England, you look at the advertisements for detergents. Fab, Clorox, All, or Persil, Ariel. People bursting the paroxysms of laughter. Honestly and truly, the happiest person I know in the world is my wife. But she doesn't go, Gewaldig, laundry. Like it's the biggest simcha in the world. Because human nature conspires against us to make us unhappy and put us in permanent complaint mode. Be it our creature comforts or our desires for food, clothing. We always want more, or at least more than our neighbor. And regarding food, this of course is my great question to God. Why is it that cheesecake makes you fat and celery doesn't? Thank you. It's one of my kashas. But, you know, it's amazing thing is, you go out and eat this enormous meal. Your friends, parents came from overseas. They took you out to this, you know, went out to eat. And at the end, you have to write, good, you're on the side like a blimp. Where are you 10 minutes later? It's just me. Where are you 10 minutes later? Are you not back at the fridge? Is there? You're at the, I think so. I mean, I went to a dinner last night. I mean, a dinner you pay. So you pay, so you want to eat, you know, you have to get your money's worth. I mean, I couldn't stop eating. I came home right away, straight into the sukkah, you know, like, let's start all over again. I work at home on a computer. That wasn't funny. The drawback of working at home, it's like, you know, studying for finals. Every 10 minutes you go for nosh. You always have to make that cake a little bit straighter. New cake, straight, new. My friend told me I should put a scale in the fridge and then a scale in the kitchen. So every time you go out, you know, you can't get out. So you have to make the following critical distinction. And that distinction is between our needs and our wants. And if your parents told this to you, they did not mislead you. Because what did the advertisers tell us all the time? You need, you need, you need. And if you feel you need something and you don't receive it, then how do you feel? Good old MOY vocab, bad. Sad. Mad, not glad. I was going to say deprived, but MMY. Everyone knows I love the school, so that's not. But if you look at the advertisements, it's a science how to make you feel deprived. You need toothpaste, which comes out of a spritzer, glows in the dark, sparkles, makes star shapes, and tastes like bubble gum. It's no good anymore out of a tube. You need, you need. It used to be enough to have a Barbie doll. Now you need a Barbie Corvette. And Ken and the Gans Mishpucha and more and more. They'll be happy, be miserable. There's always a new and improved. I tell my kids all the time. My kid says, I need to go out and play. I say, you want to go out and play. It's like a nigger in my house. You need to eat, you need to drink. You want to go out and play. The motto of Mercedes is, we at Mercedes are here to provide you with all of your needs. That would be true if they'd say, we're here to provide you with all of your wants. Could you imagine? You need to eat, you need to drink, you need a Mercedes, you need. It's a chachma. And the real experts in this regard, right, these are the expectations which are fueled by Madison Avenue, right? You need a new car, because if you're happy with your car, Detroit is not happy with you. There's always a new and improved. I'm not good at this, meaning I travel very often, but I rarely, and this is being recorded, but I rarely buy things for my kids. I mean, I have a shopping list like everyone, but I don't go out and buy them stuff. So, but every once in a while, my daughters get excited by a new bottle of shampoo. So I can't tell you I'm the smartest shopper, but I go down the aisle and I look, I see the new and improved. And one day I decided to compare the new and the improved with the old and the unimproved. And it's the same mup-a-bup-bide, and yellow number 8 and red number 2. You just switch the order, and we fall for this as if it's new and improved. And the real experts in this regard is the computer industry, where they have developed to a science how to make you miserable. They want you to know, before you move the computer out of the box, it's already obsolete. That's the hardware. The software is merciless. We subscribe to Computer Magazine, we means me, and I only did this to get a free mouse pad. And I had to stop the subscription because I couldn't tolerate seeing kids play with software I'll never comprehend. So I'm going to read you a quotation from Mac User December advertising a real fancy delancy graphic program called SuperPaint. Very expensive graphic program. And what do they say about their phenomenal product? They say, quote, "Beyond reality, you need tools as unlimited as your imagination. Take your imagination beyond reality with SuperPaint. Its speed is ferocious, its versatility is unprecedented, it's utterly precise, astonishingly nimble, sounds like a missile, and incredibly smooth. SuperPaint has rendered its competitors speechless." That's Mac User December. Comes January. Yeah. You open up Mac World, you see there's a new product in the market called UltraPaint. What do these Ultra people say about their super competitor? Quote, "Theirs may be super, but now that's yesterday's news. Evolution's never much fun for the newly extinct. Simply state, UltraPaint is everything you want it to today and tomorrow. We made UltraPaint easy, flexible, powerful, infinitely expandable, and definitely underpriced. SuperPaint users take a giant step up the evolutionary ladder." Then comes February. Yeah. Then there's a new product in the market called Ultra Orthodox Paint. Another $600. Don't be happy, be miserable. And there's no end to this. I saw an advertisement in Los Angeles Times. I'm only changing one word. "If you're not happy with your house, give us a call." Who wouldn't give them a call? You know, if you paid and refurbished, refurnished, it could always be better. But there's no end to this. You're not happy with your spouse, give us a call. If you're happy with your children, give us a call. I'd be on the phone all day long. Don't be happy, be miserable. Okay, that brings us to emotional wants, where jealousy is a major factor. The grass is always greener syndrome. And here I can tell you, because I'm somewhat involved in shidduchim, I have discovered, shidduchim meaning trying to arrange matches in young men and women, I have discovered what is the most important thing to any young woman, any young man who's dating. And by the way, what I'm about to tell you is not conjecture, but I know this 100% from my experience. What is the most important thing to any young man who's dating? Don't know this. Aren't you glad you came tonight? Time's up and I have to go? What is the most important thing?
Pretty.
Yiras Shamayim. Yeah, that wasn't funny. Okay. That wasn't even funny for Eric. You know what I've discovered? Again, what I'm telling you is not conjecture. I know this for a fact. The most important thing to any young man who's dating I've discovered is exactly and precisely whatever it is this girl is missing. She could have this, this, and this. She's missing that. That's what I need. Next one is that. Missing this. This is what I need. Immature yet true. Thus, that proverbial cup, which should be half full or half empty, get almost entirely full, and many people look at it almost entirely empty. Accordingly, what is the solution to the conspiracy of human nature which conspires against us to make us unhappy and put us in permanent complaint mode? And the answer are two words often not used in America. I'm not a big chassid of America bashing, but it's particularly an American problem. And these two words are self-control. Happiness is a battle for self-control. Or better put, happiness is a battle for autonomy. Or yet better put, happiness is a battle for liberation. Or yet best put, happiness is a battle for internal liberation. For all liberation spoken about today is always external liberation. Be it women's liberation, third world liberation, so-called Palestinian liberation. But this will not make anyone happy, because you need to be liberated from within. Those of you familiar with the story of Natan Sharansky, let's see if I can get a look of recognition. Yes? No? Very weak. Anatoly Sharansky? Anatoly Sharansky was a member of the Israeli cabinet and the Israeli parliament, the most famous Jewish dissident from the epoch of dissidents in Russia. And here was a man incarcerated at Gulag concentration camp, totalitarian, dictatorial, despotic police state, solitary freeze box. And I suspect he'd more equilibrium there than many people in the West in the lap of luxury, because you need to be liberated from within. Freedom, right? Eilecha ben Charin. Chazal teach us, there's no free man, Elmisha Osek. You can not be dependent upon the world. Which is why all these self-help courses will never work. No one wants to pay money to find out that I'm the problem, and to find out that you're the problem, not that I'm the problem. There's a sefer called Mekadshei Hashem, and to be honest with you, I never learned this sefer, but I did read the introduction of Meisels. And he describes that he's one of these unspeakable camps during the Holocaust. And he is an Eidekel, a great grandson of the Yiddish Kaddosh. And he managed to fashion for himself a talis cotton out of his Alta Zeta's talis. And one day, Nazi noticed something bunched up under his shirt. He said, "What is that?" He said, "My great great grandfather was a very godly man." He got no further, and the Nazi took his spiked trenchant and began clubbing him into an orb of blood. He said, "Before I murder you, I have to ask you a question." He made him crawl into the barracks. He said, "How can you talk about God after all you've experienced?" And this is what he said. "I don't know why this is befalling us, but I do know. If you're not well and must undergo surgery, what do I know about anatomy and surgery? But if I have faith in the surgeon, I assume that what he's operating is correct, what he's cutting and what he's plucking." The Nazi was so impressed with this answer that he nursed him back to health and gave him double rations, and that's tzaddik b'emunaso yichya. There is no appetite which cannot be addictive, and freedom and discipline are partners. The Mishnah teaches us, ezehu gibor, who is the mighty man? Not someone who can beat someone else up, but one who can't control himself, one who can't control herself. So, you have to be happy with your lot, and that's a big battle, because we're always looking at somebody else's lot. We can't appreciate that which we have ourselves. People think they'll be happy when they achieve their list of goals. Now, what is this list? It could be a list that is noble, sublime, and lofty. Usually it's not. Usually the list goes like this. I'll be happy when I am thin, bright, desirable, rich, etc. Now, my problem with this list of thin, bright, desirable, rich is rich. What's my problem with rich? Aside from the obvious, I have it not. My problem is, and we believe, we means Judaism, that money is a wonderful thing if it's used properly. But I think if someone wants to be rich in order to be happy, it cannot work. And my proof is the Forbes 400. The 400 richest men in America. I think everyone on this list, except for number one, is miserable. Or if you're from England, the 50 rich list. My heart goes out to number 396, the poor guy. 401, the poor guy. I mean, the poor guy's a zillionaire, but Nebuchadnezzar is not number one. It's always thinking what I'm missing because someone else has more than me. The problem with this list of thin, bright, desirable, rich is thinking I want to have what they have. And who are they? They are them. And who are them? Them are they. And who are they? They are them. I know not who they are. My life revolves around who they are. I don't know who they are. And here I am stuck in Preposition City, and I don't even know who they are. But I want to be happy because I want to be what they are, and I don't even know who they are. It's trying to impress someone else. The world in which I live, the world of Yeshivish Jerusalem, it is standard operating procedure. Comes Chol HaMoed, you take your kids on a tiyul. So my kids say to me, we have to go on a tiyul. I love doing this. They say, we have to go on a tiyul. And I say, why? Aval kulamos, everyone's doing it. So I tell them I couldn't give a flying flip. If you give me compelling reason, I'm attentive. Because everyone else is doing it, I graduated that. I'm not always looking at someone else. What is the screaming desire of an adolescent? To impress others. What do they think and what do they say? Unless you're either here tonight or have graduated the school of hard knocks, people don't outgrow this. What do they think and what do they say? And you can never be liberated, and then you can never be happy. 15 years ago, I'm only 27, but 15 years ago, my family and I were in America for the summer. And at that time, this is going to sound so impoverished and indigent and niggardly and pecunious, but at that time, the highest paid baseball player, if you drive in America and have the radio on, you learn all kinds of critical sports statistics, whether you wish to or not. So at that time, this antiquated, impoverished period, the highest paid baseball player was a gentleman by the name of Arl Hershelheiser, who got paid a mere $7.9 million for throwing a ball. I mean, of course, today, that's entry level for, you know, the A-Rod generation, that's entry level. And the next highest paid baseball player is a gentleman by the name of Dwight Gooden, who got paid a mere $6 million for throwing a ball. So a reporter, I dare say a clever one, interviewed Mr. Gooden, he just called him Dwight, and he said, what do you think about the fact you're earning only $6 million when Hershelheiser's getting $7.9 million? To which Dwight Gooden responded, now I cannot quote his total eloquence, but he said, what? Well, and he can't live with himself because he's getting 7.9, he's getting only 6. Why is he more? He's no better than me's. And if he's miserable, what a Nebuch the right fielder for the Phillies. He's getting a minimum of 85,000 of Ali Yidden. And I have the answer. I say, hey, bud, remember last year in the minor leagues? What was your great dream? To earn a bundle or get to make it to the majors? Do you know how American kids would give the right arm to be in the major? I don't mean the majors without a right arm, but your belly aching should be high as a kite. But we're so busy looking at someone else. If you would compare yourself to 20 people at random, you know what you'd find? 6 are nebs, 11 are depressed, 2 are the... But it's always, gee, they have it so much better. A comedian that I grew up with, okay, I didn't actually grow up with her, she was on my neighbor's TV. And such a funny lady. So many teeth and smiling and everything. So, thanks again. It's late for them. I was wondering, though, as I said it, what is a TV? I was trying to remember, microwave or something. I couldn't. Anyway, so this woman is so funny. So I read in one of these in-flight magazines that she's pushing her 6th marriage and all of her children have committed suicide. And I suspect she's not as funny as the media would convey, because it's always someone far away and in the distance. Gee, honey, the Greenbergs really have their act together. And they're saying the same thing about you. You don't see them, they don't see you. The story with the Baal Shem Tov. A fellow was carrying a heavy package up on his shoulder, climbing up a mountain, and he's scaling and climbing and climbing. Schwitzing, perspiring. At the end of the day, he looks up at the pinnacle, the summit, and he seems to be no closer from when he started off. To which the Baal Shem said, look over your shoulder. Look how far you've already traveled. That will give you the strength to keep on going. Don't look at others without, look within. The same story differently. Story of Chelm. I assume you're all familiar with the Chelm stories. Some of you, all the perspicacious, perspicuous, judicious, provident, erudite, clairvoyant, sagacious individuals live in the Chelm. There's silly stories, but this, I believe, is a very insightful story. Fellow Chelm had to go to the bathhouse, and he was very concerned that without his clothing, he'd forget who he was. For as we know, clothing identifies an individual. So He goes into the bathhouse, and so he could remember who he was, he tied a red string around his toe. Somehow, somehow, as he's taking the shower, the string got dislodged off his foot and ended up on someone else's toe. He came out of shower and he said, I know who you are, but who am I? And that's precisely our problem. We galvanize our own identity by looking with others without, instead of within who we are, and indeed who we should be. Ironically, Hollywood stars and starlets, we have a great debt of gratitude. Because you read, you think they're so happy, and then you read their memoirs, they're miserable people. Kitty Dukakis, a name I'm sure you're all familiar with. Shell? Someone here at least? Kitty Dukakis, her husband was running for president. That sound familiar at all? Mike Dukakis ran against Ronald Reagan. Kitty Dukakis, his wife, a Jewish woman. So people said, wow, what a lucky lady, first lady to be. The day after election, which they lost, she went into maniacal depression, was later housed for substance abuse. And then 11 years ago, she wrote her memoirs, and you read there, the lady's in Ganzen Toit Meshuga, off her rocker, drinks gallons of rubbing alcohol, because she has nothing else to drink. People are like, wow, what a lucky lady, only because she's far away. Said Rabbunim Parshischa, it's a famous mashal. He said, if everyone could put their pekalach, put your problems, your heartaches, all of your issues, and put them on a laundry line, and you see somebody else's dirty wash, you'd run in and take out your own dirty laundry and take it back. But we just always assume that somebody else's problem, so our situation is the worst. I don't know you all here. I'll have the pleasure of knowing at least those wise enough to be in my class better than others. But without knowing you, I can assure you that we are better off than most people in the world. Scratch. We are better off than 90% of the people in the history of this planet. But instead of being grateful and appreciative, many of us walk around like, Dwight Gooden, gee, they have it better than I. I've been all over the world. And for a moment, I don't take for granted the freedom we have, socioeconomic freedom, the liberties we have. And I'm not always comparing myself to other people. And this is our segue to the most important component to achieving happiness. And we can really pull out this Chag Simcha Seinu. And that is gratitude, appreciation, karsa tov. Let me just introduce this with a story which I know to be true because I heard it from the protagonist herself and others. It's actually a story which I wrote. As the Rav used to say, I'm engaging now in self-plagiarism. According to New York State law, the homebound are entitled to an education. This woman, who is a specialist in special education, tends to this girl in Brooklyn who is born with a rare congenital defect which has robbed her of her brain. The girl is 9 years old, lies in a crib festooned with toys she'll never appreciate, for she cannot tell the difference between heat and cold and light and dark. And she said, if the girl would ever raise the smallest pinky, it would be a major miracle. And she attempts to teach her motor control. One day she was tending to this girl, this is again in a wealthy, affluent, religious neighborhood in Brooklyn. The father was home. She had never met the father before. He goes over to the crib, scoops up the child. You know, children are soft, pliable, cuddly. So he scoops up the girl. This girl was stiff and rigid. He scooped her up, hugged and kissed her, and said without any irony at all, what do you say about her oitzer? What do you say about her treasure? After 14 miscarriages, look what God blessed us with. And a man was truly appreciative. And you hear a story like this, and you go home, and see your kid brother coloring on the wallpaper in your room, you want to hug him and not break him. And we have the obvious edge in this regard, everyone in this room, because we're taught from time we're children to make a bracha. And what's a bracha all about? That was a good response. That's right. Provided, of course, that you mean it. It means to appreciate. Provided. Now, I'm not being supercilious here. We make 100 brachos a day, and the focus 100 times. That's an august, tall challenge. But we are all competent to do it once, twice, thrice a day. We can do that. Even I can do it. And these are barbells that keep us in tone. For if you appreciate, there's a delicious inverse relationship between expectations and gratitude. The more you expect, the less grateful you'll be. The less you expect, the more grateful you'll be. To make a bracha and think, well, you know, there's a din, not a very well-known din, that when you make a bracha, when you make a motzi, you should hold the bread with 10 fingers. Because there's 10 avodas that go into the bread. There's zriya and kitzira and harisha. You thought bread comes out of a bag on a shelf in a supermarket. A lot went into it. And you're going to appreciate it more when you think about all these labors that went into this. I was flying from Israel to America. I learned in the Mir Yeshiva. And on my flight were two of the Gedolim of the Mir. Rav Aaron Chadash, the Mashkiach, and Rabbi Aryeh Finkel, whom we call the Tzaddik of the Mir. And not for naught is he called the Tzaddik of the Mir. It's a righteous, pious, and devout. You put your fingers over here, they'd be dripping with the Shechina. He walked straight out of Pirkei Avos. And when these Gedolim learned that I would be on their flight, I'm a seasoned traveler. Fortunately, they are not. So he asked me if I would sit next to them. But my policy is, whenever I travel, I prefer to sit next to someone who is not yet religious. I thought about what I'm doing in life. Most people have not. The person stuck next to me for 11 hours, that's a chance to impact. So I said I'll be juxtaposed in propinquity, but not totally adjacent. Fair enough. So Rav Aaron Chadash at the window, Rabbi Finkel, the great tzaddik, in the middle. Next to him, Israeli. I sat behind him, and next to me was a middle-aged Israeli couple. I introduced myself to my neighbor, and he tells me he is Haredi Chiloni. Meaning, not only is he not yet religious, he is zealously not yet religious. His wife explains, they Dor Shminit Yerushalmi, an 8th generation Jerusalemite, whose grandmother grew up in Batan Garmei Sharim. She was Chozeret B'Sheila. First time I ever heard that expression. That is the antithesis of Chozer B'Tshuva. She'd kicked the fold, and they're very proud of her. Needless to say, I had my work cut out for me. So I go into my spiel, gunisht, like water for duck's back. No impression whatsoever. Fall into a fitful sleep. 4 hours later, it's a night flight, dawn is cracking, and Rabbi Finkel jumps up. Here is the very first opportunity to say Brachot HaShachar, the morning blessings. He jumps up, puts on the rekel, puts on the hat, goes into the wind-up, and by no means in a quiet voice, he begins, Baruch, Ata. A couple next to me are freaking out. And he tells me, he's one of yours, you get him to quiet down. I was not prepared to cooperate. They called over the steward, and the steward said, get him off the plane. I tried to explain this is highly impractical. Emphasis on the highly. They said, call the captain. After 2 or 3 minutes, felt like an eternity at least, Rav Aryeh Finkel sits down, couple resumes breathing. Then Rav Finkel gets up and goes to the bathroom again. Comes back and once again, puts on the jacket, puts on the hat, goes back into the wind-up with all the histrionics and gesticulations. Baruch. Ata. My neighbor turns to me and says, now what's he doing? I said, sir, I'm not explaining this to you, but there's a blessing you make when you come out of the bathroom. He said, give me a break. I said, no. All you have to do is go to the hospital. If someone's inlets aren't inleting, and their outlets aren't outleting, there's a rupture, blockage, they're miserable, horrific, he is pain. Some of his ignominy changed. He turned to me and said, Atadema, you know what? Yesh b'zamash, you've got a point. The next 6 hours we're talking religion all the way to America. He then came to hear me speak. You know, he says, Rabbi Finkel's bathroom blessing that turned him around. That's what it means to make a bracha. That's what it means to appreciate. The good news is we're almost finished, but can you hang on a little bit longer? That was it. Rage? All right, so one of the seminaries where I teach a course on tefillah. My first class of the year is Moda'ani, the prayer Jew says upon arising in the morning. And I ask my students, honestly and truly, what are you thinking when you say Moda'ani? Moda'ani lefer. But if you can arise in the morning, I'm grateful I'm alive another day in front of the king to jump up in the morning. This could be distracting to a roommate, but to quietly get up, I'm grateful I'm alive. It's a great way to start the day. And I urge you, don't trust me. Try it. Think. I'm grateful I'm alive. I'm a free person. Think about this today. A free person. There's an Uncle Moshe song. And to be honest with you, if I hear it one more time, the kids went too far with this one. But it goes like this. Baruch Hashem, for the sky so blue. Whatever you do, I'm a happy Jew. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. It's awfully corny, but it's awfully true. If you appreciate your happy person, But it's so much easier to focus on what we don't have than appreciate that which we have. For it doesn't matter how much you have, it matters how much you appreciate. There's a kid that I see every single day. It's not an apocryphal story. Every single day, I see this kid, I'm walking to yeshiva in Mei Sharim. There's a kid, a Yerushalmi kid, kicking a plastic bottle. You know, a plastic bottle. Kicking a plastic bottle up and down the alley. He's the happiest kid. And he once told me, it's not even his bottle. It belongs to his aunt. The bottle, I'm talking, this is it, the bottle, this bottle. He's kicking it up and down the alley. This is the happiest kid in the world. His smile goes into the stratosphere. And then you have the kid in Long Island, whose basement is an annex of Toys R Us, and he's miserable. It's not how much you have, it's how much you appreciate. Chas v'sholom a zillion times over, you lose a spouse, then all of a sudden, these monumental, fundamental arguments are laughable. She squeezed the toothpaste from the middle, not from the bottom. What you wouldn't give now, squeeze from the top, from the side, smear the walls, just to be here. Learn to appreciate what we have when we have it. We're so used to davening like crazy when we're missing something. Chas v'sholom, you know, you get into an accident, you break a foot, or you can't see, then all of a sudden you appreciate what we should have appreciated all along. You don't have to be awfully mature to do this. You have to just be able to appreciate. Okay. So, as I travel, we're skipping a little bit, not that you would know, because we want to get to the... We want to end already. Shine, must speak. Okay. People tell me, as I travel, why aren't they happy? Because life is hard. And that's undeniable. Life is hard. But no matter how hard life is, the one thing you can always govern is how you react to life's hardness. Classic example, Auschwitz. Where they took away our pride, identity, dignity, possessions, even our hair. But they could not determine how we reacted to life's hardness. And here I refer to, of course, Viktor Frankl's work, Man's Search for Meaning. And if you are like myself and don't like to read, the book is this thin and this tall. And if that's too much, page 111 to 113, that's all it takes. They can't control the head. That's up to you. One more time to quote myself, engage in self-plagiarism. We wrote the story about Rebbetzin Meyer, an exceedingly pious woman who was sent to one of these unspeakable camps. This was a labor camp in Austria. And she was highly expecting, and she davened every day that it shouldn't be a boy, for if it would be a boy, she'd have the problem of arranging a bris. Now, I can assure you, most people in camps were not worried about this, but this and only this was on her mind. The woman had such incredible faith, she took the slop that was fed to her, buried it into the ground, so that in fact, if it would be a boy, perhaps she could manufacture, cook, produce something out of it, and serve it at the Sudat Mitzvah on the day of the bris. God played a little trick, and a baby boy was born. Then, miracle of miracles, on the eighth day, a transport arrived in the camp, and on the transport was the mail from her village in Hungary. She was ecstatically happy, said, "Must be you brought your mail messer, your knife for Mila," but he had not. She said, "No, no," she said, "it must be you made a mistake. But how could you make a mistake with those few meager possessions you're allowed to bring with you?" With such an important Rebbetzin in her honor, he looked, and sure enough, he had made an error, and he had brought the knife for Mila. Performed the bris, and she held up a little baby, Menashe, crying, and the nurse said, "Menashe, don't cry. I deny you proper bris, but with God's help, I'll yet provide a proper bar mitzvah." And 13 years later in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Williamsburg of then, there were drinks and schnapps of the lakes and oceans and rivers, and schmaltzer and gefilte fish like filled vats and tubs, and kishka and kuka filled auditoriums and plazas, and everyone's eating and drinking and merry. And Menashe gets up, delivers bar mitzvah, drushes, pshetel, a sermon. And just then, this elderly gentleman walks in from the back of the room, malodorous, odorific, wrinkled, crinkled, disheveled clothing, but eyes that are chipped from agate. He walks right up to the front of the room, and good old Williamsburg style begins to clink on a soda bottle. Menashe loy maima, shh, trying to quiet down this intruder. Menashe loy maima. One gentleman, a little more enterprising than the others, passed him a bottle of schnapps, but he couldn't be dissuasive. My rabbi said, "Ladies and gentlemen, you think you're here to attend a bar mitzvah, but you are mistaken. In fact, you're here to attend a bris." At this point, the hook is out, and they wish to hear the end of the service. My rabbi sighed. "Ladies and gentlemen, 13 years ago, we were deep in the hell, denied the pride, beaten and tortured every day. It's your mother who reminded us who we are, and indeed who we should be. And if you think what you're eating now is tasty, I want you to know that little something that your mother served at your Sudas Mitzvah was more geschmack and heavenly than paradise itself. Life is hard, but that's the way that it's configured. The one thing you don't want to do is engage in self-pity. What I learned in driver's education, indeed the only thing I learned in driver's education, in Israel, if you have driving offenses, you must take a course in driver's education. Not that I would know, but I was in the room when they were teaching this. And that is, you can be, I'm translating from Hebrew, you can be dead right. What does that mean, dead right? The light turns green and you have the right to go. And a car is approaching. Now, you may exercise your right, but if you do, you'll be dead right. Here lies a man that was dead right. R.I.P. O.B.M. Even if you have the right to complain, you do not have to exercise that right. Two women lose their pocketbook. One woman says, "Oy vey, my keys, my credit card, my phone, my wallet, my passport, take me months to replace it." And the other woman says, "Oy vey, my keys, my credit card, my phone, my wallet, my passport, thank God it wasn't me. And I'm no different than anyone else. I don't want to lose my wallet. But if I would, I'd allow it to ruin 3 minutes, and not 5 months, to learn to wreck the dike in the face of adversity. Life is hard, but that's the way that it's configured. Can you imagine Dwight Gooden every time he gets up to bat? Gee, it's so hard. They're trying to strike me out. Chucham, for that they're paying you $6 million. The Chiddush HaRim, the first Ger Rebbe, was incredibly impoverished, as poor as a shill mouse. And when the Rebbetzin opened up the cupboard, there wasn't even a crumb, let alone a slice of bread. One day she could take it along and said, "Itchemeyer, how much longer do we have to go on like this? When are you going to start worrying about our situation?" He said, "I do worry about it." She said, "How much do you worry about it?" "I worry about it 8 minutes every day." So where does that help? He said, "As much as your 8 hours every day." And that is true. It says in Shulchan Aruch, the Gemara, "Mishenichlas Adar Marbim Besimcha," when Adar comes, we increase in joy. Every seminary girl's favorite mitzvah, and you write on your door, "Mishenichlas our door, Marbim Besimcha." Very original, door after door after door after door after door. So what is the opposite of "Mishenichlas Adar Marbim Besimcha"? Right. "Mishenichlas Adar Marbim Besimcha." So listen carefully. This is such an unbelievably beautiful Jewish thing. Kutzker Rebbe said this. Picture, here's a bar. And here's the other will make a smiley, and here's the other will make a frowny. What would you imagine is the point of departure? That would be parv, straight, correct? So the Kutzker name, listen to the words. When the other comes, we increase in joy. When other comes, we decrease in joy. In other words, what's the baseline? The baseline is simcha. For the Jew has to know how to modulate a little more or a little less. But we're never bereft of simcha. We're never sans simcha. The baseline is joy. That's a Jewish perspective. Okay, just give me just a matter of minutes, and we're finished. Skip a little more. Not that you would know. Okay. Make a distinction here between fun and happiness. Here I must give credit to an essay I read by Dennis Prager. Fun is what you experience during the act, and happiness is what you experience after the act. Fun is fundamentally not a Jewish experience, which is why there's no word in Hebrew for fun, because it's beyond. People like to correct me and tell me kef, but kef is Arabic. One more time. Fun is what you experience during that. Fun is the Coca-Cola, the tingle on the tongue, or the roller coaster. When it's over, it's over. Happiness is that experience which is lasting. And I have no better example than the feeling you have Matzah Yom Kippur. And I don't mean because now you can eat. But if you really worked on yourself through Rosh Hashanah, and through an Elo, and through a Sashim Echuvah, and became a better person, and you got those sins off the shoulder, and you made a commitment that you're going to uphold and upkeep, that lastness goes straight into Chag Simcha Seinu. I heard when I was a bacher, many years ago, I heard Rav Shalom Shadron speak in a sukkah in Sanjur Mochevet. He got up and he said, this was in Yiddish, and he said, "You're holding by Chol Maid. I'm still holding by Yom Kippur." When you work on something, that's a lasting feeling, that's happiness. So let's make two distinctions between fun and happiness, and then we'll call it Rosh Hashanah Rava. Okay. Firstly, the reason that fun cannot provide happiness is because it's a drug. And like all drugs, you have to always increase the dosage. It used to be fun to go skiing. Now you must go skydiving. Now you must go bungee jumping.
For those you're not familiar, you must fly to New Zealand, tie rubber ropes around your feet, and jump off a bridge.
And only 13% die from this. It's a lot of fun. It used to be fun to watch a horror movie on your neighbor's TV. Frankenstein comes on the screen, ay, 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 ay. You know what I tell you? I never was zocha yet to see a horror movie. Although, one of my study trips overseas is always October. So be it either in America or England, that is horror season, horror movie season, at least according to the subway and the tube. And you look at advertisements every year, it's the exact same thing as the year before, but more. More blood, more guts, more organ parts than last year's blood, guts, organ parts. There's something physiological here. You have to always kick up, raise the ante. Nightmare on Elm Street. Nightmare on the Highway. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Texas Chainsaw Massacre in stereo. More and more and more. The other reason that fun cannot provide happiness, this Chazal teach us, is because fun can only be achieved without pain. Happiness can only be achieved with pain. Effort, expenditure, tircha, that's how happiness is achieved. It's samsara agra. The decision to have children, okay, the decision is painless, but children are not fun. They cost a lot, they make a mess, they're not fun. But they make you so happy. You get up early to learn. No one likes to get up early. It's not fun, but it makes you feel so happy. Or to share with you a personal example, when my financial situation was at its very worst, I'm always competing against myself, but then I won. We wrote 4 books in 11 months. It wasn't fun. It meant a lot of deprivation, not necessarily food, but certainly sleep. It wasn't fun, but mainly content in doing that which I felt I had to do. My analogy would be the difference between exercise and massage. Massage will make you feel well, but exercise gives you a feeling within of that which is right and that which is proper. But to quote my dentist, Dr. Krupka, quoting the coach from the Chicago Bears, no pain. You're the same dentist? No pain, no gain. Okay, to conclude. If you separate fun from happiness, it will liberate you in the following 3 areas. Firstly, in the realm of time. The amount of time that is hemorrhaged on fun is appalling. And here's a very good example for women, the majority of this audience. The amount of time that is hemorrhaged on spectator sports is something which is beyond my ken. Because it's not just watching the game, listening on the radio, reading the paper. If you have a kid brother, you know just what I'm talking about. It's the pre-game show and the post-game show. And the pre-game show, discussing, philosophizing. Next they start all over again. The pre-game show and the post-game show. In New York City, like every major city in the United States, there is a sports radio network. Not all that long ago, I rented a car at LaGuardia Airport, put on the radio, and it was set to the sports radio network. In my life, I have never, ever heard a more animated discussion. Jerry from the Bronx, Cecile from Jersey, Larry from Westchester, Mad Dog from who knows where, calling in, would he hit it, could he hit it, should he hit it, will he, could he hit it, should he... Until I discovered this game took place in 1957. Could he hit it, would he hit it, should he... Could... And how do I know that it can't be that important? You tell a person, you have 1 year left to live. I suspect they won't spend so much time engaged in spectator sports. Nextly, and I'm making fun of sports, it could be computer games. We know what our problems are. Separate fun from happiness. It may be fun, but it will not make you happy. Secondly, separate fun from happiness. There's a lot more money at your disposal. And this is a pragmatic argument as much as it is a mussar argument. I know that this year's dress is more fun than last year's dress. For home or car furnishings, I don't think it makes one happier. Lastly, separate fun from happiness and frees us from addictions or jealousy, for all addictions are causes of unhappiness. And therefore, to conclude, I encourage that we avoid pursuing fun, avoid comparing ourselves to others, avoid expectations, and most importantly, engage in self-discipline and engage in gratitude, for gratitude is a matter of attitude. I know I ended, but it's very rabbinic done several times, the final ending to conclude our Chag Simchaseinu is a quotation I heard from Rav Pam Zichron Levracha, the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vidas, I'm quite certain it's not his quote, but I heard it from him. Everyone's looking for the city of fun, and they don't realize it's in the state of mind. Okay, I acknowledged the very benevolent and generous Cooper family. I also acknowledged the Ornstein family. I also want to acknowledge, while I have everyone here, the tireless work of Rabbi Katz, not just keeping the school going with Rabbi Haber together, but also raising all this money is a thankless job, and he works very assiduously in this regard. A piska tova to you all.